Hope you're well. I'm Joel, and we have teaching from the Bible here every week. I'm one of the leaders here in the church. The part of the Bible that we're going through together is the New Testament book of Galatians. It's a letter written to some churches in the area of Galatia. We would now know it as southern Turkey, and it's written by the Apostle Paul, and we've been spending quite a while in it. The main idea of today's message, the theme of it that I would love you to get from what I have to say, is the freedom that Jesus brings into the lives of his people and the threats to that freedom that we need to watch out for. It's likely that you have no idea how liberating, freeing Jesus actually is. It's likely that you don't know that if you're not a Christian, if you're somebody who's not yet put your trust in Jesus Christ for yourself. You can't know just how liberating he is until you discover for yourself. But it's also just as likely that you, being a Christian, if you've already become a Christian, could be living your life kind of on a fraction of the freedom and liberty that Jesus wants to bring into your life. And there are some reasons why we allow our freedom to deteriorate, why we allow the freedom level to go down in our lives. There are some problems, there are some threats, there are some things that fight against our freedom. And that's really what this whole letter of Galatians is about. And it's good that we're spending some weeks in it. But today particularly, I want to talk about some of the threats through the story of two of the most famous leaders in the history of the church and how they had a bit of a spat in the middle of the history of the early church. They kind of came together like two heavyweights and had a rumble, and one of them had to put the other one right. And it's a fascinating story. I'm going to read it to you, and then, as I say, we'll get into it. So Galatians chapter 2, verse 11 to 21. This is Paul writing. But when Cephas came to Antioch, now, just to give you some background, Cephas is the Aramaic name for Peter. We refer to him as Peter or Simon Peter. Peter was his Greek name. Cephas is the way he would have heard his name when it was first given him by Jesus. So Paul uses that version. When Peter came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, he was eating with the Gentiles. But when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. Just occurs to me while I'm reading that, what a strange party that would sound like. But sorry, it's funny how these things don't occur to you when you're preparing a sermon. It's only when you're reading it out to hundreds of people, you had this really perverse thought in your head. It sounds like a horrible party. So what would the invites look like? You wouldn't have the boss come to my party. And the rest of the Jews acted hypocritically along with him, so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas before them all, if you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile, but not like a Jew, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews? Now, I know this is very complicated and confusing. I'll do my best to explain it. It does make an awful lot of sense when you see the big picture. We ourselves are Jews by birth, he says in verse 15, and not Gentile sinners. Yet we know that a person is not justified by works of the law, but through faith in Jesus Christ. So we also have believed in Christ Jesus in order to be justified by faith in Christ and not by works of the law. Because by works of the law, no one will be justified. But if in our endeavor to be justified in Christ, we too are found to be sinners, is Christ then a servant of sin? Certainly not. For if I rebuild what I tore down, I prove myself to be a transgressor. For through the law, I died to the law, so that I might live to God. I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. I do not nullify the grace of God. For if righteousness were through the law, then Christ died for no purpose. I grew up living in a house which backed onto a big park in Hove, and this park was a place where children would often be trained in football. You'd see them occasionally getting all the boys over to one side, huddling them up and saying, right now, here's what I want you to do after I've blown the whistle. I want you to get into your positions and I want you to get ready to pass the ball around. When we're playing, the temptation you're going to feel is to rush at the ball. Every one of you, rush at the ball. But don't rush at the ball. No. Get in your positions. I've given you your positions. Don't rush at the ball. Pass it. Share it around. Trust in the structure and the strategy. Trust the plan. Have we got that? Have we got that, boys? And you can usually see the boys all kind of nodding enthusiastically, and they're kind of really, this is like a sober moment. They're really feeling the weight of what the coach is saying, and the last thing they want to do is rush at the ball. You know what's going to happen. As soon as he blows the whistle, they're like bees after honey. It's just like, it's just all of the strategy is out the window because the sheer kind of emotion of the moment overcomes any kind of planning, any kind of ideas that came out before that moment. And that is a little bit like what we see in this story here, in as much as there had been quite clear agreement between the early church leaders about what the gospel really is and the requirement that should be given to those who were not Jewish but wanted to become Christians. Paul, who had received his message from Jesus himself, had been preaching that Gentiles, that's non-Jews, who become Christians, who put their faith in Jesus Christ, should not be required to be circumcised if they're men, or women, they shouldn't be circumcised at all, and also that they shouldn't have to observe the Jewish calendar, even the Sabbath laws, the weekly Sabbath, in the way that the Jews always had, and also that they should not have to keep the food laws that were very strict in Israel about what foods were allowed and which foods were considered unclean or common. And so this was an agreement that Paul had amongst his own disciples, his own converts, but there came a time when he knew he needed to check it out with the other apostles, the other leaders, and make sure everyone was on the same page. And he did just that. He sat down with the Jerusalem apostles and they agreed to the same point that Paul had already been preaching. They even made a test case in that meeting. Paul brought with him a Greek convert called Titus, who had not been circumcised. Now, I don't know if Titus was warned before they had this meeting what was in the balance at this meeting, because he might not have gone. But sure enough, they checked at that meeting. He checked with Peter and James and the others. What do we say about Titus? For example, here's a case study. What are we saying about this guy? He's not circumcised. Do we need to circumcise him? And it was said, as you heard last time, that they didn't circumcise him because they agreed. The Gentiles, the non-Jews that have come into Christianity, have come to Christ for themselves, they are not obliged to keep these ritualistic Old Testament laws that were given to Israel strictly as an ethnic nation during that period, those thousands of years in the Old Testament before Jesus came and in effect brought an end to the need to observe those laws. Jesus has come and changed everything. They agreed. They understood. Jesus has changed everything. We've got a new plan. We've got a new strategy. We're not supposed to chase after the ball. We get it. We understand. We're going to keep our positions and we'll stick to it. The problem is, as Paul says, when the pressure comes in certain ways, people forget the plan, forget the strategy. They don't hold the line. They even forget their convictions and they yield to whatever feels right at the time, and the gospel in this situation has been a bit lost. That's what he's getting at in verse 11 when he says, when Peter came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. Now, what's Peter done? Well, Peter, in this case, he just goes on to describe it, but I'll just summarize it for you. Peter, having agreed with Paul, had been happily eating Gentile food with Gentiles. Now, for us, that might seem very ordinary, but trust me, it was shocking. It was taboo. It would have been considered vulgar and obscene during his upbringing in Israel. Now he was happily doing it. Peter was happy. Why? Well, a few things had happened in his life. He'd met Jesus. Jesus himself very clearly was happy to eat with people that no one expected the Messiah of Israel to eat with. And not only that, but Jesus even said explicitly in one or two places that, the food laws were not that important. He said such things as, it's not what goes into a man that makes him unclean, but it's what comes out. It's what's in the heart that matters. The food laws aren't as important as the teachers of the law have kind of thought. Jesus taught some very radical things, some very shocking things for the Jews of his time to hear. Peter himself even had the privilege, after Jesus had been crucified and raised from the dead, of his own personal vision. Some of you know the story in Acts chapter 10. It describes how Peter saw this sheet coming down out of heaven with basically, you know, Jamie Oliver's kitchen in it. It's just every conceivable kind of food is in this sheet, including all the unclean things, supposedly unclean, that he would never have eaten. He would have said, I'm not allowed to eat. And the voice of God comes to him saying, arise, kill and eat. And Peter spouts his famous lines of Christian discipleship, no, Lord. He's very good at saying that. You might have noticed Peter saying that in a few other places in the Bible. No, Lord. It's a contradiction in terms, but never mind. And God has to say to him, Peter, he has to speak to him strongly. He says, do not call unclean what the Lord has called clean. Do not call common what the Lord has called clean. I'm telling you, Peter, these ritualistic, these laws about food, they're done. I want this gospel, I want this Jesus to be known and sat with and enjoyed in Christian communities that span the globe. I want ethnic groups of all different kinds, colors, shapes, backgrounds. I want people of all kinds, all ethnicities, all types, to happily sit together and eat their food together in the presence of Jesus, to break bread together. I want this fellowship with Jesus at the table, at the feast, the banquet of heaven, to be filled with all kinds of different foods and flavors. And I want this richness, this diverse banquet to happen. Peter, don't hold things up in your Jewish traditions. I'm letting this gospel break out to the nations. And Peter has to humbly step up and accept that those days are over. He starts to preach it. He starts to live it. And it looks like everything's fine. It's like Peter's clear as a bell. Paul and Peter are in agreement. It's all fine. But then something happens that makes Paul concerned. In fact, it gets Paul very concerned. And he feels the need to rebuke Peter even publicly, which is a big deal. If you've ever been in a meeting where someone has got up and publicly rebuked somebody else, especially someone as highly respected as Peter would have been, the Jerusalem apostle. This man was the senior figure in the early church. Paul is doing something unthinkable and rebuking him. It must have been so important to Paul. Why would he do this? How could you do this? How could you be so disrespectful, it seems, towards Peter? Well, presumably or clearly, Paul felt it was that important. The stakes are that high. It is that necessary. If we don't get this right from the start, Peter, the church is sunk. This gospel will go nowhere. And the freedom that Jesus came to bring us into will be robbed of us. We cannot allow this to happen. So Peter had gone back to his very insular behavior. He stopped eating with the Gentiles. Simple as that. Again, we might think that's very trivial. I tell you, it was a marked, marked statement. Now, Peter may have done it subtly. It may have been a very gradual change. He may have just kind of slunk back and hoped no one noticed. He may have done it very nicely. He may have said, you Gentiles, it's lovely to have you in the church. It's very lovely to have you at some of our meetings. I'm just going to eat with the Jewish brothers from now on, though. He may have tried to cover it up and make it natural and nice and easy, but Paul saw right through it and understood that something massive was being played with here, and it wasn't appropriate. He needed to deal with it personally and even publicly, because Peter was a public figure. This was a public issue. I must address this, Peter. You must not do this. You must keep the table open to everybody. Jew and Gentile, we are one at the table of the Messiah. Paul's longing for this. He's fighting for it. He yearns for it. So he's prepared to do the unthinkable and pick it up even publicly. But here's the thing I want us to look at in the time that we have remaining. Why would it be that Peter would shrink back? You can see it in verse 12. Before certain men came from James, he was eating with the Gentiles. When they came, he drew back and separated himself. And then the rest of verse 12, fearing the circumcision party. He's fearful. There's something's happened to Peter. Something's intimidated him. Something's got under his skin. He's lost his freedom. He's allowed his liberty to be compromised straight after the whistle blew. They agreed to this. They fought for it. They really agreed. They made decisions together on principle. They stood together. They said, no, this guy won't be circumcised. We'll keep the table open. We'll stand by what Jesus has taught us. But when the whistle blew, he lost his way. And you see in verse 13, Paul, with probably a hint of real heartbreak in his tone, says, the rest of the Jews acted hypocritically along with him so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy. Even Barnabas. You can hear Paul's kind of tone of indignation. Even my friend, even Barnabas, of all people. And if you know Barnabas's story a little bit, you know Paul's history with Barnabas, you know that would have been a big deal. His closest friend, probably. And the one who, up till then, had done the most to encourage the Gentiles. Done the most to build churches that were filled with Jew, Gentile alike, coming to Christ on the basis not of their behavior, but on the basis only of faith in Jesus. Barnabas had always got it right. And he's thinking, even Barney, even the best of the best, has fallen. Why? Because Peter is setting the wrong example. Therefore, Paul's thinking, I've got to deal with this publicly, because he's leading the whole church astray. And he takes up the issue. This is massive for him. It's not small for him. It's not small for us. What he says is, let me use verse 14 as the way in to this issue. This is a very important verse. When I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, that's worth pondering for. When I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel. So he doesn't say, when I saw that they were breaking the rules. When I saw that they were being racist, he could have said that. But, or even, when I saw that they broke our agreement. He's not saying any of those things, actually. The way he deals with this is, when I saw that they were not walking in accordance with the truth of the gospel, it's not in step with the gospel. Now, here's the thing, friends, you need to understand, the mistakes we make, the messes we get into in our lives are made when we do not walk in the truth of the gospel. What I mean is we start living as if Jesus hasn't come. We live as if Jesus did not live, die, and rise from the dead. That is what Paul is fussing about. Peter, you're living as if it didn't ever even happen. You've forgotten that what Jesus has done has changed everything. It's no small thing. Jesus hasn't just tweaked a few details. Jesus has changed the map. Jesus has torn history up by the roots. Jesus has transformed the universe. Jesus has fundamentally shifted reality. It's that big a deal that Jesus has come. He's been born. God came and was born of a virgin, lived the life he did, was crucified and raised from the dead, and now he's seated as a man at the right hand of God, the God-man. If you don't understand that that shifts all reality, then we're going to have trouble all our lives. We need to learn to live according to the truth, in step with the truth of the gospel. It's interesting. Paul uses a word that we don't find in many other places in ancient literature, a Greek word that basically means walking straight. We get the word orthopedia from it, orthopedia, or even the word orthodontist. It's the Greek word orthos, to do with straight. He's not being straight. He said, you're not getting your life according to the clear path that we agreed on, that the gospel sets us free for. It's like you go to a dentist, an orthodontist. They're concerned about keeping your teeth straight. And so they might give a child a brace because they see at a young age, you know, you can tell that this is exactly what I didn't have. Somebody coming and saying, right, we need to help your child, we need to correct this. And we need to stick a brace in there to make sure that in years to come, there's straightness, there's structure, there's the appropriate straightness. And really, it's a bit like that with the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's like Jesus has brought liberation to our lives, freedom from religion, freedom to know God, to walk in the truth of the gospel, the power of the gospel. But it requires a certain kind of sticking to it, a certain kind of faithfulness, a straightness for us to enjoy the actual liberty of it. He said, you're in danger of actually going off course here. Your teeth are going to go all over the place, Peter. We need to keep you straight in this situation. Peter's an interesting character, as we know. We've talked about Peter quite a lot this year because if you've been in the church for a few months, you'll know we started the year off in Matthew 16 where Jesus speaks to Peter himself and gives him his name. He used to be called Simon. Simon, I call you Peter. I will give you a new name, Peter, the Rock. And what we know about Peter is that temperamentally he was a robust person. He was a passionate person. He could be very courageous from time to time, but he wasn't necessarily as steady as a rock. He wasn't as straight and clear on course and consistent and constant as he might have done well to have been. At times like this, you see his changeableness, his fluctuations, his inconsistency, his failure to stay on course. And I just want to look at how it is that Peter loses his grip on the straight, clear message of freedom, and as an extension of that, how we can as well. See, Paul's telling this story to the Galatians for a reason. He wants them to know that they are being just like Peter. He's saying to them, guys, you need to understand, as a church, you look like you're going to drift back into those old rules. And you shouldn't, and you don't need to, and you're free from them. You are free from that crushing slavery to trying to please God through external regulations, through your own performance and your own efforts to try and show God that you're worth it. You don't have to. You've been set free by the sheer gift of grace from the slavery of religion. But you're going to drift back there if you're not careful. He sees it happening in the churches in Galatia. He sees them listening to bad teaching and going all off course. And he's saying, guys, let me tell you about Peter, because he wants them to see if Peter can go wrong, friends, you can too. Hold your course. Hold straight. Hold a clear, consistent commitment to life in the good of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Let me look at the threats. I've just got three main threats to freedom that we will find in our lives. The first of them is the past. The past. I think for Peter, this was an issue. His past. He knew that he was probably, in some respects, less qualified to teach on religion than some of the people that had come up from elsewhere. And he was aware of his own failings, his own weakness. And it's also the agreement with teachings from his past that he hasn't properly addressed. He hasn't looked at his past in the light of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And friends, that's true of many of you in this room as well. You haven't confronted your past in the light of what Jesus has done. You still live as if the past is unchangeable. The past doesn't get touched by the gospel. The past controls you more, it seems, than Jesus controls you. And you let the past dominate the conversation. You let the past become the end game. You let the past win the match. In your own mind, in your own conscience, in your own sense of encouragement or fear, peace or inner conflict, it's decided over the past. It's not decided over what Jesus did. Peter's got a story of Jesus giving him a new identity. Simon, I call you
Peter. Jesus has actually worked hard, it would seem, to help Peter away from his past. But even so, Peter's living in the past still. He uses that language in verse 15. Paul speaks, I guess, with a bit of irony to Peter when he says, "We ourselves are Jews by birth and not Gentile sinners." He's kind of quoting their historical prejudices. "We're not Gentile sinners. I know you, me and Peter, we've got this background, haven't we? That's the way we used to think about these Gentiles, that they were outside of God's possible, they couldn't possibly be loved by God, and they're outside. They're the sinners. We're the perfect ones." We know that's our past. And Peter's still living as though that past controlled things. Yeah, I'm acceptable to God because of Jesus, but also because I'm Jewish. And Paul's got to say, you've got to get away from the past. That's never really been the reason why you were ever acceptable to God, was it, Peter? It's only because of Jesus. It could only be because of Jesus. Nothing else that you would have to offer. The past can be in our minds and our lives way more than we realize. Way more. You know, in the book of Exodus, the children of Israel get rescued from slavery. It took them one day to come out of slavery. It took 40 years for slavery to come out of them. It can take one day for you to become a Christian. One day to know I'm free. I'm forgiven. I'm righteous. I'm declared righteous. It can take 40 years for that sense of the past to be pulled away from you. It may be that that's what's happening in all of our lives to some extent. But friends, don't allow it. Don't allow the past to control you. If Jesus has rescued you, Jesus has redeemed you, to know freedom from it, to have a joyful liberty from it. Let me look at the second thing quickly. It's not just the past that controls us or threatens our freedom. It's just cultural taboos, culture that's got into under our skin, cultural kinds of do's and don'ts that we've kind of promoted cultural things to sacred things. We let cultural customs become spiritually authoritative. We let them become absolute and sacred. So the thing that you grew up thinking was sacred more by habit than by anything that the Bible clearly teaches, it's very hard to touch it. You get sort of sacred cows in your life. That's an expression that's very common. You know, don't kill sacred cows. It's a big sacred cow to kill. Don't take that away from me. That feels like a big deal. The reality is Jesus spends a lot of his life putting sacred cows on the altar in the Bible. Jesus spends a lot of our lives dealing with sacred cows, things that we have considered to be untouchable. Don't go there. Don't touch that bit of my life. That's sacred to me. It's like that in church life. When things change, when we move this round, or we change the order of a service, or we squash things, or we lengthen things, there's an awful lot of pain that we feel as Christians. And it's kind of understandable because it's not just people being obstinate. It's not just people being miserable. It can come across like that sometimes. But actually, the reason why is because underneath we're touching something that can very often feel incredibly important to people. This is how I meet God. And you're playing with it. You're playing with the meetings. And it's not a small thing. And we can allow those customs to become the non-negotiables, the deal breakers, instead of at least questioning, saying, how much of that is central? Is that as important as I've allowed it to become in my imagination, that particular detail? We need to be good at that all the time, just judging carefully. What things should become sacred in our imagination and what shouldn't? Peter had not properly followed through, it seems, on how free he was. Jesus' voice came to him in the vision with the sheet coming down. I told you about this with the animals on it, saying to him, "Do not call unclean what I have called clean." Don't do that, Peter. That's a huge thing for Peter to get his head around. This is a guy who, from young age, as a kid, he would have grown up being told, "We do not eat those foods. We do not. On pain of death, we don't eat those foods." There were stories of martyrs who refused to eat non-kosher foods while they were being tortured to death by the Hellenists, by the Hasmoneans and the people that attacked Israel. They were tortured to death because we will not eat those foods. This is huge. This is sacred. This is our national identity. This is our family. This is our stories we tell our children. We don't eat those foods because we're brave, because we stand out. And now Jesus' people are going around saying, no, you can eat whatever you like. That's terrible. Sacrilege. It's disgraceful. Friends, it's a big deal, isn't it? But the truth of the gospel is so mighty that we must allow it to even trump some of the sacred things that we've considered untouchable in our lives. Things that I can't imagine a spiritual person doing this. Well, if you can say why from the Bible, then you're right. But if you can't, then be careful. You may be setting up a very religious kind of shrine to something that shouldn't have a shrine in your mind or in the culture. We need to just be wise and discerning about that. Third thing, and final thing, is the most obvious, really, just people. People in general. These are the things that threaten our freedom. It seems to me that this is Peter's story here for sure. You see it again in that verse 12 where it says, before certain men came from James, he was eating with the Gentiles. But when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. He's struggling white because of people. Because there are certain people that have influence on us, right? There are certain people whose approval we desperately need. There are certain people whose disapproval we are terrified by. There are certain people who therefore have control over us. There are certain people that we basically need. And listen to me. The people that you need will be the ones who will basically control you. People who you need will be the ones who have influence over you. And if we spend our lives desperately craving the approval, constant affirmation of certain people, whether it's the crowd in general, whether it's social media, whether it's certain individuals, certain people, it's weird, isn't it? It's very unpredictable. That's why you get UFC fighters who wouldn't be scared of anyone except their mum. Serious. You watch it. You watch some boxers and stuff. They'll take on anyone in the world, but they would never cross their mother. Never. And I'm being deadly serious. And you should too. Some of you know exactly what I'm talking about. You would never cross your mum. Never. Because she has authority over you. She controls you more than the gospel does, more than the freedom that Jesus has brought you into. It's nothing about, she's not tough. You could take her out in a moment. But you're just terrified. Just totally under control. Dominion. Certain kinds of people. It's a family thing. Even interesting, certain men who came from James, came up from Jerusalem. What's going on there? James is the brother of Jesus. The brother of Jesus. Wow, that's a big deal. The brother of Jesus. He could never go wrong. And these men claim to be representing James. Therefore, they're never wrong. They're basically the Pope. They're never wrong. Paul's saying they're wrong. They're wrong. They don't line up with the gospel. They're wrong. Did I hear you right then? See, spiritual authority can be falsified. Even from people who have genuine authority and deserve respect. And everyone deserves respect in a sense. And certain people are worthy of great respect. Senior people in the church can say things that are wrong. Wrong. That's why Paul said, you remember in chapter 1, verse 8, even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to the one we preached to you, let him be accursed. if Peter could go wrong, Paul definitely can. It's not actually in the end, even the apostle can go wrong. Even the pastor can go wrong. This is why we need the gospel of Jesus. We need to be those who search the scriptures and make sure that we're on course, that we're straight, that we're orthodox. Because it's the safeguard for our freedom. I've been in situations where people have had spiritual authority like I couldn't believe. People who could heal the sick in a way that I've not seen before. People who've got remarkable gifts of prophecy. People who can say at a meeting, there's somebody here and your name is X and this is the thing that you've done and God wants to do this in your life today. And they're free. Something extraordinary happens. That same person could teach something the following minute that is patently against the Bible. That happens often. What do you do in that situation? I tell you what way too many Christians do. They say, well, we've got to believe it. The man of God said so. He's spiritual. I've got to believe it. I've got to believe it. I can't disagree with him. He's a man of God. And Paul's saying, don't even believe me if I say something that goes against the gospel. Don't even believe an angel if an angel contradicts the gospel. Angels, wow. Angels, are worried. I mean, imagine if an angel came in here. We'd all be on our faces. We would. That's why you read the book, you see what the angels are like. We'd be terrified. Paul would be standing there with his notebook. Let's just check. In fact, let's just get our Bibles out. Let's see what the angel has to say. Be watchful. Be careful. What you're into. Some people will intimidate. And it's not even their fault necessarily. It's not because a false teacher necessarily is trying to deceive. They may be totally innocent. They just need someone to put them right. Like Peter did. Peter just needed Paul to say, don't do that. And they became good friends. You read 2 Peter chapter 3, you realize they were completely reconciled. So it's not disaster. It's just we got to stay very clear, focused on the power and the truth of the gospel, the freedom that it brings to us. Now, Peter knows all of this, but somehow he's just lost it. He knows it. He agrees. He got the vision. He met Jesus. He knows this. He should be very clear on this stuff. But I tell you, like I said earlier, this man is not the same constant man that Paul seemed to be. You remember the story of when he walked on the water? We talked about this earlier this year. Peter's doing the same thing here. He walked on water, but he still fell in. He's very like this, isn't he? He's very like me, basically. Probably like you. What you know, like, for example, I am walking on water. You can be robbed of what you know when the situation, when the whistle blows and the ball is in play. I forget what I knew. I forget the liberty that I had. Is that what you do sometimes? The gospel of Jesus brings freedom to us. Some of us, we would say to ourselves, I would rather die than lose that person's approval. The idea of crossing that person is like death to me. You know what Paul would say to you? Galatians chapter 2, verse 20. He'd say, I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Why is Paul happy to stand up? Why is Paul able to be clear and straight when Peter isn't? Why is Paul not intimidated by the false teachers? Why is Paul so brave? I think it's because he's perhaps understood more deeply. Maybe he spent more time reflecting on the fact that he has already died. Some of us, like I said, will think, I would rather die than make that person disapprove of me. Paul would say, I already died. I died with Christ. And this life, this world, it's dead to me. I don't need anyone's approval in the end. I actually don't. I might feel like I do, but I actually don't, because I have Christ's approval. I belong to Christ who loved me and gave himself for me. To just know that and to sing about it as we will in a moment, to come to the table as we will in a moment and enjoy his table fellowship, which anyone can come to if they know Jesus Christ. If you put your faith in him, you don't need to obey a whole lot of rituals and laws. You just put your faith in Jesus who loved you and gave himself for you. You will be justified. It will be declared that you are righteous. It changes everything. You don't need to justify yourself. Imagine this. Imagine a family playing a board game. And it's very competitive. You know, there's been a lot of tears and accusations of cheating. I'm sure some of you know exactly what this feels like. And there's one boy in particular who's very passionate about winning. And his brother or sister is also passionate. They're kind of desperately wanting to win. And their father has been away because he's a soldier. He's been away overseas fighting for months. And he's been demobilized. He's free to go home. They have no idea what day he's going to arrive home. They're just playing a board game in the living room. And while they're playing, while they're getting to quite a heated discussion about who's winning and what's, you know, who's going to win and did you just cheat and all the rest, there's a knock at the door and they realize that Dad's home. And in the kind of all of the mess, all the fuss, all the excitement, the board just gets kicked and all the pieces get scattered, all the Monopoly money, whatever, just scatters everywhere. It's like, it's just apocalyptic. It's just the game is done because Daddy's at the door. It just changes everything. Changes everything. I don't need to win this game. I don't care about the game. I just don't care anymore because of him. He's come. He's home. We can be with him. I don't need to win the game. The game doesn't even signify. But there's one boy who stays at the room and he keeps trying to put the board back together and put the money in place. So, no. He's just carrying on saying, I'm going to win. He's desperate to win, cannot not win. And it's like his dad is there. He doesn't even notice his dad, doesn't even care about it. He cannot stop himself from trying to win the game. This is how I'm going to get approved. This is how I'm going to get justified. I must prove that I won. I must. That's what we do. That's what we do very easily as Christians. We must win. We must prove. We must demonstrate. We must display our value, our worth. We must find a way to validate ourselves. The rest of the family don't even know. They don't even care. The game's over. The game's finished. That's what he's trying to say. The law, that whole way of trying to please God, that way of trying to live like, I will prove it. I will make it clear that I'm worth it. I will be valued by God. I'll be valued by others. I will make I will be approved of. It's gone. It's over. It got kicked over at the cross. It was finished. Jesus, it's apocalyptic. It's over. The death and resurrection of Jesus Christ brought an utter end to that. Paul says, I've been crucified with Christ. I just don't live that way. It's just not me. And it's over, Peter. I know they will hate you. I know they'll speak against you. I know it will get you into trouble. But friends, we have Christ. I live no longer as I anyway. Christ lives in me. In the life I live by the faithfulness of the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. What could be better? He's found that is rich enough to satisfy his soul.